It actually hiccuped. And then we'll try again. There we go. All right, that looks fine. Good. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavidyan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Chaitanyam Sarvagam Sarvam Sarvabhutaguhashayam Yat Sarva Vishayatitam Tasmai Sarvavide Namaha. Very nice. Welcome back, and welcome to all of the students watching these classes online. We continue today in our study of Chapter 12, which is called Prakasha Prakaranam, the chapter talking about consciousness as light, Prakasha, the light of consciousness, so to speak. But as I've mentioned before, the contents of this chapter, and that word, if you remember, was chosen as a title because it's the first word of the first verse. So we have to know that's a common style. The chapter, though, has to do more with false identification. And that's one of the central issues we address in the teachings of Advaita Vedanta. And that is, whatever we falsely identify ourselves with, those objects of identification become cause suffering. So you identify with your body. How? I am male, I am female, I am young, I am old. With that identification, your body becomes a source of suffering. Of course, you know that you, just to set the context, you know that you are the consciousness, your essential nature is, you know, our Vedantic language, your essential nature is Satchidananda Atma, pure consciousness, the observer, the witness, the consciousness which makes you aware of everything that happens, and importantly, consciousness which remains unaffected by everything. Just as the sun illumines everything without being affected by what it illumines, in the same way, your consciousness is utterly unaffected by anything and everything. So, when you fail to identify yourself as that consciousness, and instead, due to ignorance, identify yourself with your body, I am male, I am female, etc., you become subject to the problems of the body. Similarly, you can identify yourself with prana. I am tired, I am alert, I am sick, etc. I am strong. You can identify, and this is the main topic for today, you can identify yourself with your mind. I am happy, I am sad. And watch this. You can, do I want to do this right here? Yeah, you identify yourself with the qualities of your mind. When sadness is present in your mind, as we've discussed in many classes, that sadness is a property of your mind and not of the consciousness that reveals it. This is Vedanta 101. And what am I looking for? Oh, I'll take a black pen, because I use that sometimes as a prop. You know, it makes a very, thank you. It makes a very good point here. I am the observer of this pen. It happens to be a black pen. Blackness is a property of the pen. It's observed by me. Therefore, I am black. Where's the reasoning in that? But notice the metaphor. Blackness is a property of the pen. Sadness is a property of your mind. What's the difference? The pen is observed by you. The blackness of the pen is observed by you. Your mind is observed by you. The sadness in your mind is observed by you. This is classic, the term that's used in Vedanta is aviveka, failure to discern properly. Blackness is a property of the pen, sadness is a property of your mind. Now, our topic that Shankara introduces in this next verse, and also a little bit later, I hope we'll come to that verse, is this. Enlightenment means gaining atmajnanam, self-knowledge, means removing ignorance. Ignorance belongs to whom? And this is actually a technical topic that some commentators on Vedanta love to argue about. What is the locus of ignorance? Where does that ignorance reside? Avoiding all their complicated arguments, the obvious answer is the locus of ignorance is your mind. And when you gain knowledge, I am Satchidananda Atma, where that vritti, that thought, that recognition, where does that recognition take place? In your mind. So ignorance and knowledge have their locus in your mind. Ignorance and knowledge are properties of your mind. Watch this. The blackness of the pen belongs to the pen. The sadness of your mind belongs to your mind. The ignorance of your mind belongs to your mind. The enlightenment of your mind, the knowledge of your mind, belongs to your mind. Then we can ask the question, how can you possibly say, I am ignorant or I am enlightened? That's like saying I am black, like saying I am sad. Ignorance and enlightenment belong. Let me not use the word enlightenment. Ignorance and knowledge belong to your mind, and that is our next topic. Drishirupe sada nitye, drishirupe sada nitye, darshana darshane mayi, darshana darshane mati, katam syatam tato nanya, katam syatam tato nanya, ishyate nubhavastataha. Ishyate nubhavastataha. End of the second line. Mayi, in me. And this is Shankara using this rhetorical device where he makes consciousness speak. Or it could be Shankara himself speaking, but I think more it works as consciousness is speaking to us. Consciousness says, mayi, in me. Go up to the top line. Mayi, in me, who is what? Nitye, in me, who is eternal. And sada, drishi, rupe, in me, who is eternal. And sada, always, drishi, rupe, in the form of consciousness. The one who exists, drishi means seeing. And here it's a metaphor for consciousness. The one in me, in fact, instead of in me, better to say, with respect to me, who is eternal, unchanging consciousness, with respect to me, darshana adarshane, it's dual now, darshana, seeing or knowledge, adarshana, not seeing or ignorance, knowledge and ignorance, katam syatam, how could they exist? How could they exist in me or with regard to me? Consciousness gets ignorant? This is one of the important discussions in Advaita Vedanta. Consciousness doesn't suffer from ignorance. Consciousness is not affected by ignorance. When the sun shines on darkness, space is dark, right? When the sun shines on darkness, or when the sun shines on something that's black, how is the sun affected by that? Not at all. And when that sun, in the same way, when consciousness, this is tricky, when consciousness illumines ignorance, what in the world does that mean? Do you know the Chinese language? How do you know that you don't know Chinese? How do you know that you don't know Chinese? Ignorance of Chinese language is known to you. You know your ignorance. Point is, ignorance is in your mind. It is known to you. It is illumined by your consciousness. The presence of ignorance is known to you. The absence of ignorance is known to you. If I say, do you know your email address? You know it very well. So knowledge and ignorance have their locus in your mind. Like blackness belongs to this pen, maleness belongs to this body, sadness belongs to the mind, so too knowledge and ignorance are properties of the mind, not consciousness. Consciousness doesn't become enlightened. Okay, so katam syatam, how could knowledge and ignorance exist in me or with regard to me, who is eternal, unchanging consciousness? Tataha, there are two tatahas here, the last one. Tataha, therefore, tataha anyaha anubhavaha na ishyate. These words are kind of jumbled. You remember that in these verses, to suit the meter of 8 syllables per quarter, word order is often jumbled. So Shankara concludes here, then, for this reason, tataha anyaha anubhava. And anubhava, remember we discussed that word in the last class. Anubhava means experience. But Shankara and other great teachers of Vedanta use it also in the sense of realization. The term often used in commentaries is atma anubhava, which could be misinterpreted as experience of atma. You see the problem with that, right? Who is the experiencer? Atma. Can the experiencer experience itself? That doesn't make any sense. So be on alert with regard to this word. In English, the word experience is used very loosely. And here Shankara is using it in a very specific meaning, and that is enlightenment, and I've translated it here, realization. So anubhava in the sense of realization, Shankara's point here is tataha anyaha. What other kind of anubhava, realization, any other kind of realization, na ishyate, is not possible. Except for the realization, I'll paraphrase the whole verse, except for the realization that ignorance and knowledge are properties of the mind and not properties of consciousness. Shankara concludes in that last half, other than this, there is no realization. There is no enlightenment. So fundamental to enlightenment is the realization that Atma doesn't get enlightened. That's his point. Then, yat stastapo raverdehe Yatstastha Puraverdehe Drishe Savishayo Yata Drishe Savishayo Yata Satvastastadvareveha Satvastastadvareveha Drishe Savishayastata Drishe Savishayastata. Shankara is widening up the point he made in the prior verse. He says, Yatstaha tapaha, not tapa, tapa, I mispronounced. Tapaha, heat. What kind of heat? Ravehe tapaha, the tapaha, the heat of the sun. The heat of the sun, dehe, on your body. The heat of the sun on your body is yatstaha. It abides in your body. When you sit out in the sun, of course, it's not very, very hot today, but hot weather is not far ahead. You know how it feels when you're out in the hot sun. What do you say? I am hot. Everyone says, I am hot. I am black. It's the same thing. I mean, hotness is a fact. Blackness is a fact. But the blackness of the pen belongs to the pen. The hotness of your body belongs to the body. Yet we insist on not just saying. We think, I am hot. We think, hotness affects your true nature as consciousness. That's a huge error. There's a huge confusion. That's that aviveka, that absence of proper discernment I pointed to before. This is a confusion, and confusion that makes you suffer. If instead of saying, I am hot, by the way, that statement, I am hot, is coupled with the conclusion, I am miserably hot, and I will not be okay until I make my way into an air-conditioned room. This is suffering. On the other hand, the sun is hot, this body is hot, is a fact. It's a situation. Remember, I gave my guru's language here. You can convert a problem into a situation by using these teachings of Vedanta. A problem makes you suffer. A situation is just something you deal with. I am miserably hot is a problem. This body is hot is a situation. Go and find an AC room, no problem. But let that hotness, let that heat not cause suffering. And Shankara makes this very clear, that heat, which is a property of the body, that's the first line, Shankara says, saha vishayaha, that is an object, drishehe, an object of consciousness. It is an object of which you are aware, of which you are conscious. Anything you are conscious of is separate from you, knower and known, observer and observed, me and a black pen, completely separate. So this is his point. So the heat that is present in the body belongs to the body, and is an object of consciousness, being an object of consciousness, separate from consciousness. Now he goes one more step. He says in the middle of the third line, tadvat, in the same way, satvastaha. So previously we had yatstaha, that which is in the body. Here we have satvastaha. Here sattva doesn't mean sattva guna, it means mind. Be ready for this. In the Bhagavad Gita, in other Vedanta texts, sattva often means, often we'll say, sattva often means mind. And the reason for that is the mind is primarily sattva guna. Just like the body is primarily tamas, and the prana is primarily rajas, rajoguna, in the same way the mind is primarily sattva-guna, therefore the mind is sometimes referred to as sattva. Therefore, sattva-sta here means whatever is in your mind. What is in your mind? Happiness, sadness, etc. And he says that tadvat, in the same way, sattva-staha, whatever is in your mind, iha eva, at the end of that line, everything that is present in your mind, tata, in the same way. You see the yata at the end of the second line and tata. Just yata, just as, here, tata, in the same way, whatever is in your mind, saha vishayaha, that too is an object, drishehe, of consciousness, just like the blackness of this pen is an object of consciousness, just like the heat of your body, hotness of your body, is a property of your body, in the same way the sadness in your mind is a property of your mind. And yet we go on, I am hot, I am sad. This conventional language and conventional thinking makes you suffer. Look at the difference between I am so sad and there is deep sadness in my mind. Those statements feel very different. I am so sad, that exaggeration, means I'm really suffering. On the other hand, there's deep sadness in my mind for some very good reasons. There's some objectivity there, and that objectivity doesn't remove the sadness, it does remove suffering. Remember our distinction between sadness and suffering? Sadness is a mental state. Suffering is your response to that mental state. How could this happen? A loved one dies. How could this happen? The sadness and grief are normal feelings when a loved one dies. But that feeling, how could that happen? The inability to accept. This is an interesting definition of suffering. Suffering is, and you'll be very surprised by this, but it is so meaningful. Suffering is your inability to accept reality on its own terms. Can I say that again? Suffering is your inability, your resistance. That's even a better word. Suffering is your resistance to the reality of the present moment. Conversely, if you have complete acceptance of the reality of the present moment, there's no suffering. There might be sadness, but look at that. If you have complete acceptance of the presence of heat in your body, you feel hot without feeling miserable. In the same way, if you have complete acceptance of the presence of sadness in your mind, you have sadness without misery, without suffering. That's the point. All right. Then.
Pratishadhedamam shognyaha. Pratishadhedamam shognyaha. Kami vaikaraso dvayaha, kami vaikaraso dvayaha, nityamuktastatha shuddha, nityamuktastatha. Tattha Shuddha Soham Brahmasmi Kevalah Soham Brahmasmi Kevalah.
I'll break the words apart for you. Pratishiddha Idam Amshaha. Remember we used that word Idam Amsha in last week's class? The this part. And let's remember that very profound analysis of experience we did in the prior class. Right now you're having an experience. In this experience, there are two parts. What are those two parts? One is chit amsha. By the way, when those two words come together, it becomes chid amsha. The word is chit, consciousness. But as a compound, chit amsha. Chidamsha means the part of your of this experience, which is consciousness, which is you. By the way, it's also called ahamamsha, the I portion. Chidamsha or ahamamsha. But there's something else going on in this experience, and that is whatever is around you that you're experiencing, and that's what we call idamamsha. Remember, idam is the Sanskrit pronoun this. So there is, in this experience, there's a chidamsha, a part that is pure consciousness, and an idamamsha, a portion that represents all the objects that are experienced. This is true in all experience, and this is one of the very profound... Probably true that Shankaracharya was the originator of this language. I don't know if there's any evidence of this particular analysis being used before the time of Shankara. Might have been, but I don't think we have any evidence. So this is Shankara's brilliant analysis of this experience. In this experience, there are two parts. There is a chidamsha, pure consciousness, and an idam amsha, whatever it is we are experiencing. So in this verse, Shankara is talking about the jnaha, the knower, which means consciousness. What kind of consciousness? Consciousness which is pratishiddha idam amshaha, consciousness which is pratishiddha, from which is removed. What is removed? Idam amshaha. Consciousness which has the idam amsha removed. Actually, not that nyaha. Can I retract what I said before, consciousness? Because I want to stay with what I opened with. It can mean consciousness. I think it's more helpful here if we say experiencer. Who is the experiencer? You are. I am. We are all experiencer. So let jnaha here mean experiencer. You, the one having this experience right now. That experiencer who is pratishiddha idam amshaha, when you remove the this part from the experience, you are the experiencer. Suppose we could somehow use an eraser of some kind. It's kind of silly, I know. But some way to erase the thisness, the idam amsha of this experience, which means, and what is the thisness? Everything you see, hear, taste, smell, and touch is part of the thisness. Any thoughts in your mind? Anything known to you as an object, any object known to you, object is this. So this room, this Swami, this lecture, anything that's a this, imagine it being erased, so to speak, from this experience. What else this? This thought. This emotion, anything that is this, remove it. Is consciousness a this? A that? An it? Consciousness is not an object. Consciousness is I, to use the proper pronoun, right? Consciousness can only correctly be referred to with the pronoun I. There is no this consciousness, and this is part of our struggle with language. I think you'll appreciate this. There's no such thing as this consciousness or that consciousness. There is only I consciousness, the consciousness which is your true nature. Consciousness is not an object of any kind. So, jnaha, the experiencer, when for the experiencer, the idam amsha, the thisness, the this part of the experience, when it is removed, what remains? So finish up that eraser thing. Everything you see, hear, smell, taste, or touch right now, erase it. All of your thoughts, erase it. Any emotions, erase it. What's left? You, I, pure consciousness is left. And that consciousness, Shankara says, is kamiva. Kam is a word for space. That consciousness is like space. Consciousness, space is commonly used as a metaphor for consciousness. Why? Space itself is attribute-free, yet it accommodates all attributes. Everything that exists, exists in space. All the attributes of everything that exists, exists in space. Yet space itself has no attributes, like consciousness has no attributes. Also, space has no edge, no boundary. It is limitless, boundaryless, ananta. Therefore, it is all pervasive. So just as space cannot be contained in an object, just like space cannot be contained in an object, in the same way, consciousness cannot be stuck inside your head. Space is present both within this pot and outside of this pot. In the same way, consciousness is present inside your head, but it's not trapped inside. It is all pervasive. So kamiva, consciousness is like space. And like space, consciousness is ekarasa. Ekarasa means having one essence. Here, rasa means essence. Having one essence. Many times it's translated homogeneous or homogeneous. And I remember when I started reading Vedanta as a young man, I don't know if you even remember this stuff, but in the 1950s and 60s, when I was growing up, it was a big deal to have homogenated milk. Now we take it for granted, but back then it was a big thing. And so every time I heard the word homogeneous, I thought of milk. Not very helpful, but just be on the lookout. This word ekarasa, having one essence, is like milk. So before the 50s and the 60s, your milk, some of you remember this, your milk came in a bottle, and at the top of the bottle was the cream. That's how milk used to be, not anymore. So now it is ekarasa. All right. And consciousness is advayaha, non-dual. We're going to come back to that because it comes in a very profound way in another verse or two. So we'll come back to that. So this is consciousness freed from the idam amsha, By the way, consciousness freed from the idamamsha. Remember, we used that mirror metaphor, I think in the last class or the class before, maybe both. So you stand in front of the mirror. Idam. The one you see in the mirror is idamamsha. It is this part of you. You, standing in front of the mirror, are the aham amsha, the I portion. So standing in front of the mirror, there's an idam amsha and an aham amsha. These are the two parts, and that's why Shankara likes this language. It's a little technical, but when you get the hang of it, it's really, really helpful. It makes things so clear. So he concludes here. He gets into his kind of poetic groove, so to speak. So he says that this experiencer, freed from this part, is like space. It is of one essence. It is non-dual. It is nityam, nitya muktaha. It is eternally free. Remember, ignorance doesn't affect consciousness. Therefore, consciousness is nitya muktaha, eternally liberated. Tata, also that consciousness is shuddha, pure in a sense of unaffected, untainted, just like the sun isn't tainted by what it shines on. I've given the example. The sun shines on a pile of filth. The sun is unaffected. Your consciousness reveals whatever happens in your mind in the same way, utterly unaffected. This is what the word shuddha here means. Translated as pure, but in context, it means utterly unaffected by whatever is revealed by consciousness. Shankara concludes, soham brahma asmi, and I am, aham, I, asmi, am, saha, that brahma. I am that Brahman, I am that absolute reality, kevalaha, I am that alone. Brahman here used synonymously with consciousness. How can you do that? One of the Mahavakyas happens to be prajnanam brahma. Prajnanam means consciousness. Prajnanam brahma. Brahman is that all-pervasive, non-dual consciousness. That's the highest teaching of Vedanta. We're not going to go into the details here, but don't be surprised when in a text like this, when consciousness, Atma, and Brahman, when they are equated, we shouldn't be surprised. That's what Vedanta teaches. Next. Vignatur naiva vignata. Vignatur naiva vignata paronya sambhavatyataha paronya sambhavatyataha vignata ham paro muktaha vignata ham paro muktaha sarva bhuteshu sarvada sarva bhuteshu sarvadha. We have more references to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad in this verse and the next verse. As I've said, it seems like Shankara was either teaching or studying that Upanishad while he was composing these verses. So he says, Vignatuhu, paraphrasing the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Vignatuhu na eva vignata. Na eva vignata, there is no knower, vignatuhu, of the knower. There is no knower of the knower. This is one of the conundrums, paradoxes that people sometimes think is confusing in Vedanta, and it's not confusing, it's a misunderstanding. There is no knower of the knower. You are the knower, your consciousness is a knower. Here's where the confusion comes from. You are the consciousness by which your mental activities are known. You are the consciousness, mental activities are known, knower and known. Simple? You are consciousness, mental activities are known, knower and known. Then you say, but who is the knower of that consciousness? The knower of the knower of your mind. Is that what you experience? Do you experience yourself as the knower of And the problem with this logic is if the knower of the mind, if the knower has a knower, then this knower has a knower, this knower has a knower, and we end up with an infinite series of knowers. And which is silly because it's contrary to our experience. Are you one knower or are you an infinite series of knowers? In terms of your own experience, we experience ourselves as one. So you are that one knower. Now, this logic is often used to dismiss any other consciousness. Prior verse said, advaya, non-dual. Now we'll get a little better explanation of how can we say with such certainty that consciousness is one. One of the teachings you've heard here many, many times. One consciousness manifest or reflected in many minds. Excuse me. One consciousness, all pervasive consciousness reflected or manifest by many, many minds. How can we be so certain? How can we say that so almost dogmatically, not dogmatic at all. It's backed up with lots of scripture and lots of reasoning. One reasoning we've just given is that if there's a second consciousness, that consciousness is knowing your consciousness, and that consciousness is known by another, So we refuted that as being illogical. Here Shankara gives a different refutation. So one common refutation of many knowers is this mathematical one. You end up with this infinite regress. Here's a different refutation of multiple consciousnesses. He says, vijñātuhu na eva vijñātā. There is no knower of the known. He says, there is no knower who is no anyaha vijñāta, no other knower who is paraha sambhavati, who can be, para has beyond or above, but here it has a sense of more pervasive. There is no consciousness beyond your consciousness, outside of your consciousness, beyond your consciousness. It's like space. In fact, we saw that in a prior verse, kamiva, like space. Can there be two limitless spaces? We use the word akasha. Akasha means the space in which the universe exists, akasha. Can we have space one and space two? I know that some modern theorists are talking about multiverses and all kinds of pretty out there things. I don't know how else to describe it. Here, let's just stay a little bit more grounded in our experience. So the universe exists in space. In this universe, can there be space one and space two? Space one is all pervasive. there's no room left for space two. Anything that's all pervasive precludes the existence of anything else. There's no room left over, so to speak, for it to accommodate. So this is the argument Shankara uses here. He says that like space is all pervasive and cannot accommodate a second space in the same way your consciousness, and I'm saying your consciousness, to make a point, your consciousness is not stuck inside your head, is not stuck inside your body. Your consciousness is all pervasive. My consciousness is all pervasive. Can we have two all pervasive consciousnesses? That's the whole argument. It's not possible to have your all pervasive consciousness in addition to my all pervasive consciousness. Then who wins? We'll turn it into a contest. Does your consciousness win out or does my consciousness win out? And the answer, of course, is neither. The whole concept of your consciousness and my consciousness is a false concept. There is no your consciousness. There is no my consciousness. There is consciousness, which is adwaya, which is non-dual. One non-dual consciousness manifest in every sentient being. Shankara then concludes, vijñāta aham. He says, therefore, aham, I am that vijñāta. I am that vijñāta, that knower, the knower who is paraha. And here again, para can mean above or beyond, but here in the sense of all-pervasive. I am that all-pervasive consciousness who is sarvada, always, sarva-bhuteshu, always manifest in all sentient beings, always abiding in all creatures, and that consciousness which is muktaha, referring to what we discussed before, that consciousness is not affected by ignorance. So I am that one all-pervasive consciousness, Shankara concludes. We'll see one more verse. There we go. Okay.
Yo veda lupta drishtitvam. Yo veda lupta drishtitvam. Atmano kartritam tata, atmano kartritam tata, brahmavitvam tata muktva, brahmavitvam tata muktva, sahatmagnyo na chetaraha, sahatmatvam itaraha.
Kind of a nice topic. Who is enlightened? If you had to list criteria that would determine that someone is enlightened, what criteria would you write down? What we're going to see here is Shankara gives three criteria. First two are pretty obvious. Third one is surprising. We'll see that. So what are Shankara's three criteria for one to establish that one is enlightened? He says, one who is enlightened is Yaha Veda, one who knows what? Alupta Drishtitvam. So Alupta Drik is another reference to the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Shankara is in his groove here. Drishtitvam, consciousness. The state of being awareful. Alupta, if you remember that word, uninterrupted. One who knows oneself as unchanging consciousness. Criteria one. Criteria one, you know yourself as unchanging, all-pervasive, non-dual consciousness. Atmanaha kartratvam tata. Criteria two is the akartratam, the non-doership, atmanaha, of Atma. Atma is not a doer, which means, criteria one, you know that you are unchanging, all-pervasive, non-dual consciousness. Criteria two, you know that that consciousness is not an agent of action. Actions are involved with prakriti, as Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, and prakriti is completely separate from consciousness. Prakriti is separate from purusha, to use the terminology of the Bhagavad Gita. Second criteria. Criteria one, I am consciousness. Criteria two, I am not an agent of action. Now, criteria three. So suppose you get it, and you say, I know that I am unchanging consciousness. I know that my consciousness is not an agent of action. Therefore, I am enlightened. And Shankara, at this point, would give you a big X for having said, I am enlightened. Because the third of his criteria is tata also muktva, excluding brahmavitvam, the state of being a knower of Brahman, the state of being enlightened. So one who knows himself or herself to be pure consciousness, unchanging, all-pervasive, non-dual, one who knows that that consciousness is not engaged in any kind of activity whatsoever, and also one who knows I am not enlightened. Why would you say that? I am not enlightened. Consciousness doesn't get enlightened. If you're really enlightened, you're identified as Satchitananda Atma, which is Nitya Mukta, which is eternally free, eternally enlightened. So if you say, I am enlightened, X, you have failed the test. By saying, I am enlightened, you demonstrate the fact that you're still identified with your mind, right? Ignorance and knowledge belong to the mind. But then the question comes, then who gets enlightened? This is, we'll end with this discussion. It ends up being a topic that's much discussed. Who gets enlightened? Does your body get enlightened? It doesn't mean, if you lose weight. That's a bad joke. Really bad joke. Sorry about that. So, your body doesn't get enlightened. Does your mind get enlightened? Now, please remember how mind is understood in Advaita Vedanta. Your body is made of physical stuff. Your mind is made of non-physical stuff. Your body is made of sthula bhutas, physical stuff. Your mind is made of sukshma bhutas, non-physical stuff. Stuff is stuff. Does stuff get enlightened? You get the point? So just like your body doesn't get enlightened because it's not a conscious being, in the same way your mind doesn't get enlightened because, and I mean not conscious, sentient being, we'll say. Your body is stuff, not a sentient being. It doesn't get enlightened. Your mind is stuff, subtle stuff, not a sentient being, so it doesn't get enlightened. Conscious, what's left? Consciousness. And for all the reasons we've just discussed, consciousness doesn't get enlightened. Then who gets enlightened? No one? Vedanta removes the problem of suffering. We call it enlightenment. But really speaking, you don't get anything. You don't reach anything. You don't achieve anything. It's a matter of removal. You remove the ignorance that causes suffering. When the ignorance is removed, the suffering goes away. We call it enlightenment. And we say, you have achieved, you have gained enlightenment. But do you see that reaching or gaining is figurative? In logic, I'll just leave you with this thought. They actually use some startling language in logic to describe moksha liberation. They describe it as praptasya praptihi, gaining what you already have. It's like the lady who lost her necklace and looking all over the place for her necklace. She always had it. That's what enlightenment is to discover who and what you always were. Figuratively speaking, we call it reaching enlightenment, but really speaking, it's the removal of ignorance, and fortunately, when that ignorance is removed, suffering comes to an end. This is a proper way of understanding enlightenment. Okay, that's a good place to stop for today. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kashchid dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritangamaya. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om tat sat.